The general topic is God and faith in autobiography. And this is from a term college course that I have done for several years. And what I attempt to do there, and to a degree attempt to do here, is not simply to review a life of a significant person with religious interests and issues, but to draw out some theological insights. I am not trying to set forth a stereotype of a conversion or alternative conversion ways, but simply deal with the text as given. This week, with 5 hours to deal with, I'm going to devote 3 hours to C.S. Lewis, and I have somewhat changed my topics, though I'm giving almost as much time this week as I did in the 10 study course. Today, I've announced the topic of mysterious ways. And tomorrow, the topic is God is God. I think I am on tomorrow's schedule again for 4 o'clock. And I'm not exactly certain. It's a long way off. And if you are here, you can check the schedule as I'll have to. I may be on at 7 o'clock, which I have used quite often before. And the topic then is a baptized imagination. Then on Thursday, and I haven't the slightest idea what my time is then, I will be dealing with Dag Hammarskjöld relating to his classic journal, Markings, and talking then about self-understanding and wisdom. And on Friday, sometime, saying yes. And obviously, that has here a religious and a conversion significance. I checked earlier today in the bookstore, and there are some copies of the Lewis material out for sale, as well as some copies of Hammarskjöld's Markings. This is the cover of Lewis's book, Surprised by Joy, The Shape of My Early Life. In it, Lewis says in his own introduction that he will, at the request of friends who were interested in knowing from him how his religious outlook had changed, it's the story of how he went from atheism to Christianity. It is not a sort of dramatic atheism. It is more a matter of a private stance which is altered. But this is, as I think you know, most of you, C.S. Lewis country. Evidence of that is the fact that in the adjacent library, which is down the corridor here, the door is closed now, but it swings both ways, I think. And on the right-hand side is the circulating library, and on the far wall to the right, by the window, there are reserve books, which you may read there, but please do not take out. There is a copy of Surprised by Joy. One lady I saw in there last week said, I've read almost all of it, I've got to hurry up so I finish reading it before I leave. So you have the option there of dabbling with the material, and if you will become interested enough, there is a very limited number of books available in the bookstore. Likewise, and I should add here before I get on to the Hammarskjöld, there is a table with a section about that long of C.S. Lewis writings. These are available for loan. Simply notice what it says about how to fill in the card and where to put the card and be responsible to bring the book back before you leave Holden. There are also a few copies of Hammarskjöld's markings. Both of these are in paperback and are modestly priced. There is on that reserve shelf a hardcover edition of markings. That's the only one copy, but that's advantageous because it's a larger book and larger print, and probably some of you appreciate larger print as I do. The same rule there too. Please read it in the library, put it back in the reserve shelf so that somebody else may come at a different after a different meal setting perhaps and enjoy the book without saying, where is it? Now, I'm not going to say much about myself. Whatever I say will be redirected, corrected, amplified, made worse, or something, as I go on talking. There may even be some of my autobiography that emerges from this. Usually there is. I don't apologize for that, but I heard through sort of a grapevine that there seemed to be just a lot of Minnesotans around here. Probably too many. So I decided to assume some protective coloration. I am from North Dakota. I was born there and raised there, and on the way back we're going to visit my old home town, a little town in north central North Dakota. And whether you are from North Dakota or just have driven as fast as you ever could through it, you realize my situation. I am one of an endangered species, and the whole government is supporting our survival. I can say then, in that same spirit, that I have taught 2 months at Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington. And I was on an exchange there, and on those two occasions I found people who had relatives in that unnameable state. Emmett Eklund, with whom I exchanged first, enjoyed the month in the unnamed town, in the unnamed state, because it put him one block away from where his son and his family was living. There were 2 grandchildren there. They're sort of the primary concern. And just this last January, I exchanged with Ken Christofferson, who had his mother living in retirement in the unnamed town and a son living in an adjacent large town, also unnamed. Incidentally, of course, in the unnamed town, in the unnamed state, I taught for 28 years and 10 months to finish out, 29 years and 10 months. I will have some mention if I don't miss it here. Lewis wasn't very good at mathematics, and I've always liked Lewis, and a lot of his spirit has flowed into me. I don't balance my bank book regularly either. I could do it, but it's so much work. Just think of all the Lewis material I've been able to read in the time that I have saved by not doing foolish things like balancing to the last penny or nickel. Now let me start with this peculiar title, Surprised by Joy. In some ways, I am cheating you on a larger development of this idea, although something will emerge today. I do wish to start in a different vein. I was telling the young man who is back there seeing too that these golden words are being recorded on tape, that today's presentation would be in the main different, at least a reordering of materials that I did last week. I did not talk then strictly about mysterious ways. I think you recognize that phrase more readily than Lewis's. God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform, and I wanted to stress that. Well, the word surprised correlates with mysterious. If we are surprised, something unexpected happens. Something that is distinctive and unique. Lewis ties it in with what he calls joy. And the first intimation of this comes from a piece of Wordsworth's poetry where the phrase is used and where I think we get a little bit of a narrative indication of what this mysterious way, this surprised element involves. This is a sonnet, and in some ways it's appropriate to tell how I found this, because all you have in Lewis is the phrase surprised by joy and a bit more, Wordsworth. Now, I am not a student of English literature, and I am a Norwegian. I think that's permissible, even if I'm not from Washington, which means I'm sort of stubborn and I would sort of like to do things myself. So instead of going to a friend in the English department, I decided I'd look this up myself. I got a paper-bound volume of Wordsworth's collected works and discovered it had close to 900 pages in it. And for even a stubborn Norwegian to go paging through 900 pages seems to be more than you really want to do to nail down one citation. But the Hebrews did things backwards. And the fronts of their books were the backs, according to our reckoning. So I got the peculiar notion, and it's supported, I think, by the rules of random chance, that I was going to be just as likely to come to this quickly from the back as from the front. Worked. On page 863, I found a poem. Surprised by joy, impatient as the wind. Surprised by joy, impatient as the wind, I turn to share the transport. Oh, with whom but thee, deep buried in the silent tomb, that spot which no vicissitude can find. Love, faithful love, recalled thee to my mind, but how could I forget thee? Through what power, even for the least division of an hour, have I been so beguiled as to be blind to my most grievous loss? That thought's return was the worst pang that sorrow ever bore, save one only, when I stood forlorn, knowing my heart's best treasure was no more, that neither present time nor years unborn could to my sight that heavenly face restore. It is a sad sonnet. Someone has lost a spouse. Someone has gone into the depths of grief, unallayed, constant, and also with the sense that it would be wrong to admit a smile or laughter or joy again. And then we are not told the occasion, but in the midst of this, this bereaved, sorrowing person feels something that can only be termed joy. And the poem reflects not only the astonishment, but the sense of guilt. How could I feel this way? I was not setting myself up for it. I didn't feel that I was ever going to enjoy this again. There's a poignant, similar story that I recall reading in the Saturday Review some years ago. One of the columnists there had lost his wife. And coming back to his desk to go to work, tells how on one day, as had been his custom when his wife was alive and at home, something came to his mind that he wanted to share with her. And he picked up the telephone, he had the telephone there, and was beginning to dial before he realized that she was no longer there to answer the phone. It's that kind of peculiar, unexpected, but poignant experience. And Lewis talks about certain experiences in his life as that kind of mysterious surprise. Now, I said I would be touching on that. Let me move along with some other elements, some of the mysterious happenings. I don't mean in the sense that he didn't know what was going on, but he did not know the consequence. He did not know what subsequently would be made of these. One of the first is Lewis's description of the death of his mother when he was yet a small boy, had not been sent off to school, had been taught some of his elementary lessons in his home by his mother. She is stricken with a disease. He lives in a house close to that, as would have happened then when people were not whisked off to the anonymity and the distance of a hospital. But he is a small boy who sees the nurse scurrying about and really is not told exactly what has happened or is happening. He prays for his mother, and it is the prayer of a child who believes that God answers prayers, and God answers them directly. What he wanted was that his mother's life should be spared. There is the letdown when God does not hear the prayer, and a negative reaction to what kind of a God is this. Now, later on, he was to say that the God to whom he was praying was to him a magician. And that has its own straightforwardness, and we realize for how many people, not preschool children, that is the nature of God. It is God's business to hear our prayers 24 hours a day, all our life long, because he has the power and he ought to have the will. Now, the death of his mother left him with an older brother with whom he was always very close, and a father who had no gift for closeness. And this poses a problem for both the boys that persists even when they are grown up. Perhaps there is some justification in that the father never remarried. He carried his own grief, his own solitude. But somehow, when the boys needed a tenderness and a care, their father could not provide it. There is the next thing to an open hostility. Just one indication of the kind of inability to cope with these boys, and they were not great problems. The father would welcome them home later when they had both been off at school and say, "Now, boys, you're home and this is wonderful. We're all together here, and I want you to tell me what you would like to do when you are home." So for a while, they sort of believed the promise and that it would be carried out, and they told him what they would like to do. Strangely, when it came down to the decision, the father managed to say, "Well, I think this is what you want to do." And after a while, they decided there was no point in asking him because he was not listening to them. He was not able to sense that maybe they didn't want to go and visit distant relatives and have to be sort of grown up and wear Sunday clothes with tight collars. This is not something any more than the other elements that I will be mentioning can be given a certain coefficient of power, so that thereafter Lewis's attitude was always such and such. It does not respond mathematically, but it does give us a beginning idea of the kind of isolation, the kind of separation from a lot of social contacts that we find in Lewis's early life. He was sent off along with his older brother to begin his studies at a private school at some distance. He was a boarding student, and if you look at one of the books on reserve, or no, one of the, it's on reserve, I'm quite sure. C.S. Lewis, Images of His Life. It's one of these clumsy type things. It's got pictures in it, so it doesn't stand up there like the other books on the shelf. And there is somewhere in there, and the pictures are, to my mind, quite jumbled up, a picture of the sort of, well, call it a dormitory room. It looks almost more like a penal colony room in which these boys live. It is sparse and bare. There are no curtains in the windows. The bedsteads are that frightful metal kind that you may have encountered somewhere along the way, probably in barracks or probably in a primitive Bible camp. You get the impression that the mattresses are about that thick. They started out a little bit thicker, but they have been beaten down. No, nothing to give sort of warmth to it. And you have boys here who are kept under rigid discipline. And in that community, Lewis's sense of isolation is aggravated by several factors. Children can be very cruel to one another. They can be cruel to those who are different. And in a couple of significant ways, Lewis was different. He was still Anglo-Saxon. But he was sort of a freakish kid because he didn't like to play games. Now, he mentions that there was something wrong with his thumb, so he couldn't bend his thumb properly and couldn't get a good grip on a cricket bat or handle a ball well. But he didn't really care. He didn't want to spend time out there. That was one difference. And the masters of the school also had as a firm belief that sports were good for you. Competition was part of what you should learn. Get out there and mix it up. Cry babies don't play. What are you trying to do? You know, protect yourself. Get out there. And you can imagine, of course, when somebody isn't interested and doesn't have a lot of natural gifts, that soon he becomes the butt of jokes. Hey, come on, Lewis, come on. You're letting the side down. The second element is that he is different because he loves books. He always has. He obviously has tremendous intellectual gifts, and that, too, separates him. He would much rather be in the library reading, just as he had done at home, because his father loved books, and there were books galore on the shelves and on the floor and stacked up here and there. I suppose there wasn't a single room without an excess of books. I was sort of amazed last week. A woman that I had known from college emerged, met her first after a Vespers. I hadn't realized that she was coming. I didn't know her married name. I haven't seen her, I suppose, since college, and that's a long time ago. But we got reacquainted. I met the fine man who's her husband, and we chatted quite a bit about old times, some of the people we knew. And I shouldn't even mention this because it has some overtones that seem to be rather boasting. But she said, you know, in college I looked at you and And you were that smart intellectual guy. I hardly dared talk to you. Oh, come on. But isn't this our attitude if we see a brain, a grind, somebody that overwhelms us, knowing all kinds of things, especially if we cannot pin that person down and say, well, you sound like you know a lot, but you just blew it on the facts of the case. Well, there is a disability here that Lewis suffered. Now, let's see, I have a reference here. I might be able to prove that I'm not just making this up out of whole cloth. The real trouble was he had been flogged. That meant he had received some kind of physical beating, which was permitted even in good public schools. Good for you. The real trouble was that I think I now became, thanks to Fribble, a marked man, the sort of dangerous new boy who skips clubs. And those are the sort of athletic groups. At least I think that must have been the main reason why I was an object of dislike to Tennyson. There were probably others. I was big for my age, a great lout of a boy, uncoordinated. He would have been welcome if he had been able to control himself. He could have been a good middle guard. And that sets one's seniors against one. I was also useless at games. Worst of all, there was my face. I am the kind of person who gets told, and take that look off your face, too. Notice once more the mingled justice and injustice of our lives. No doubt in conceit or ill temper, I have often intended to look insolent or truculent. But on those occasions, people don't appear to notice it. On the other hand, the moments at which I was told to take that look off were usually those when I intended to be most abject. You know, sometimes you can't win. Now, what's another element here? I mentioned the reading, and my students have always been sort of angered by this. Even though they're college students and presumably good ones, they don't like to read about somebody who knows about more books or different ones than they know. So when you read Lewis's Surprised by Joy, there's a whole bibliography. Almost every page has something that he's read. And I confess, I haven't read them, and most of them I don't want to read. A lot of philosophy that I haven't touched on as sort of an American interested in a limited amount of philosophy. But now to see how some of this love for reading works out. And along the way here, there's a point that I'd like to see enlarging. There are exceptional things that happen. There are unexpected things that happen. And there are unexpected things that happen from ordinary things. With all of this reading, it is rare that Lewis said, and from this came this particular insight or this particular understanding. But there was an occasion when, again, very much at random, I think it was on a station platform as he's waiting for a train, and the British have little bookstalls there because when you ride a train, you can read. And there was a book there that he had not seen before, and he hadn't read it before. There probably weren't too many on platforms like that. It was a book called Phantastes by a rather obscure 19th century writer, George MacDonald. Lewis picked this up and became intrigued by sort of fairy tales with a religious character to them. They weren't just Grimm's fairy tales or something like that, but a very powerful religious insight. here's what he says about this. In reading Chesterton, as in reading MacDonald, I did not know what I was letting myself in for. A young man who wishes to remain a sound atheist cannot be too careful of his reading. There are traps everywhere. Bibles laid open, millions of surprises, as Herbert says. Fine nets and stratagems. And here is a delightful sentence, the kind that Lewis sprinkles through his writings. And you notice the language is used, traps and nets. God is, if I may say it, very unscrupulous. See, he baits a trap with things. Here is somebody who's reading, and God sort of puts not the Bible in there, which probably would not at this time have intrigued Lewis at all, but this book of stories, and fairy stories at that, fantasties. It wasn't science fiction. They hadn't invented that yet, except for Jules Verne, probably. But he says, I didn't know what was happening to me. You know, wham, I get hit in the dark. And from there on, he sought out all of MacDonald that he could find. This name may not be terribly familiar to you, but on the other hand, some of you may, by accident, because it looked like it would be a good gift book for somebody, not too expensive, you have seen George MacDonald's Diary of an Old Soul. Al Rodness at Luther Seminary sort of moved to get this in print, and the late artist at St. Olaf, his name will come, has done some watercolors which have been lithographed. You'll see those about 8.5 by 11 for sale in the bookstore. I've got to just let the tapes get going away back there. There are also some other books, and I think there are one or two of them on the shelves in the bookstore. There are writings of MacDonald's that Lewis edited. He loved him so much that he wanted to get more people to read it, make them available. And notice here what Lewis has said. When you're an atheist, you're likely to get blindsided or trapped some way. There's a lot of language just in the titles of Surprised by Joy where you get this sense that God is pursuing, that God is playing a chess game. And in the way of the dedicated chess player, it is all directed to getting your opponent into check and finally into checkmate. Those are titles he uses. I don't want to illustrate too much here. I'll fall out of my chair or trip over something, but you have a sense that Lewis is just backpedaling madly to try to get away from God, and he can't escape him. And this one little thing is an indication of it. Surprise! God is pursuing you. Now, there's another element that I know, as I have chatted with a number of villagers over the past couple of years, strike some people with a little extra force. Lewis was involved early in the Second World War. As we know, the British had to recruit as much strength as they could before they got either the materiel or the personnel help from the United States. We have a way of looking at army experiences as being rather profound. Lewis may be consciously putting this down, but his reactions, the mysterious things that are happening, are almost too neutral. And here's just another excerpt. Thus, on my very first night in France, in a vast marquee of drill hall, where about 100 officers were to sleep on plank beds, two middle-aged Canadians at once took charge of me and treated me not like a son, that might have given offense, but like a long-lost friend. Blessings upon them. And he goes on with some of similar things. This was not so very exceptional. There were nasty people in the army, but memory fills those months with pleasant transitory contacts. Every few days, one seemed to meet a scholar, an original, a poet, a cheery buffoon, a raconteur, or at the least a man of goodwill. Now, there is more, of course, and he was not just sitting around telling stories and drinking French wines. Actually, he was in the trenches. He was in there long enough to stop some shrapnel and be sent home. There's also a story which he passes over very quickly about having been instrumental in taking considerable number of prisoners. He puts that aside and says, take prisoners? And oh, they came up, you know, with their hands up, and I was just the one who happened to receive them, but he got the credit for it. Mysterious element here is that there was not some tremendous change. Remember the phrase, there are no atheists in foxholes? That is not the Lewis experience. Now, I have tried more and more as I've gone on, found out how single-minded I am. Take some time in the middle of the hour for some comments, some questions, or just to get the pot boiling, some responses to suggestions such as this idea. We've been looking at several experiences of Lewis, and we don't have to make them out stranger or more mysterious than they are, but let's just consider this. Given the same experience in life or environment, what may happen to two individuals? Is there always the same response? Do we have a one-to-one relationship? Some of us may look back and say, there was this particular incident in my life that really changed the direction. My work, my education. I've never been able to understand it, but I look back now and say, that's the way it was. And it's not the whole issue, certainly, but it's a clear indication that we can't say we are the product of our imagination or of our environment. We are at the mercy of these things. But certainly each of us, and I don't blame you for being reticent, we can look back and say something changed some aspect of my life. It was like the surprise by joy, the accident, something that we did not predict or foretell. Sometimes people have had to restructure their lives long before some major physical problem emerges because of aging. Are there certain things that you cannot do? For 20 years, I have used this sort of thing for a supplement. And for 20 years, I have not been driving. So when I left town or needed to go someplace, I had to have a driver. And I don't try to assess it other than to, you know, keep my mouth shut about it enough so that I'm not crying. But I've kept in the same professional line. There have been some things that have been possible, some things that have been more difficult, and in the nature of the case, some relationships that have been deepened. Because other handicapped people, in this limited way even, could say, well, you probably understand because I see you don't have such good eyesight either. And I think we may have experienced that when we've been in hospitals. We've met people there who have been probably sharing the same experience of anguish over that sick person who's there. And suddenly, we have found ourselves opening up to strangers in a way that we wouldn't do. You know, we know some of these people better than we know people in church. Now, I will say you had your chance. I don't want to be vicious about it, but maybe there is somebody who still wants to get in before I go on with some more. And I'm going to first setting too, so I promise you when the bell rings, we close shop.
What was the name of the city you were in North
Dakota? Well, I start out near Minot.
Near Minot?
Yeah. And Minot is a city of some size. And my hometown was a village, not like Holden, but it deserved the name of village and became a city only by the grace of certain peculiar laws. It is Upham. Now, you haven't heard of that. I met somebody here last week that had. I could say, well, I've heard of Keene, North Dakota, too. We were good friends. You see why I say we're an endangered species? Our state is endangered. Now, my notes here say, the mystery of the accidental, the unpredictable.
North Dakota is not too mad.
Well, I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying that we'll not try to compete with larger states. We'll recognize that we got something the rest of the world hasn't got. We can be like Oregon that says, we've already got enough people, don't send any more here, don't stay, just pass through. There's another interesting thing here to get on with some data. I mentioned the Army experience, and I mentioned also Lewis's trouble with simple arithmetic. Well, there was a test that he was supposed to pass in mathematics to get into a certain program at the university. And when he came back to the university after his war experience, they had changed the regulations, just as after Second World War, they allowed students who could show competence, you know, and probably an interrupted high school career, but could hack it, to get into college or university without having that high school diploma, that precious thing in their hand. Well, Lewis sneaked into the university because they said, oh, well, if you don't qualify in that, all right. Which is an intriguing thing because he moves on to become a university teacher and professor. One of those strange, mysterious things. Now, where are we here? This occasional experience of joy. And one thing, immediately, he's not talking here about happiness. And to sort of get the whole complex of what he means by joy, you need this paragraph and other instances where he says, and he's used this peculiar term, he was stabbed by joy. That doesn't sound very pleasant, but it is a sudden, sharp experience. I suppose something like the sting of a bee, although that leaves some lingering effects. Or since I come from that other state, the bite of a mosquito, of which we have quite a few, which also leaves some lasting effects. Meanwhile, back at the text. With that plunge back into my own past, there arose at once, almost like heartbreak, the memory of joy itself. Now, just listen how he's putting these words into a constellation. Joy, heartbreak. The knowledge that I had once had what I had now lacked for years, that I was returning at last from exile and desert lands to my own country. There's something familiar about it. The French would say something like déjà vu. You think you've had an experience before. And the distance of the twilight of the gods and the distance of my own past joy, both unattainable, flowed together into a single
unendurable sense of desire and loss. That's not something that you have. You just say, wow, did I have the experience? It's terrific. It excites wanting, but also says, where is it? Which suddenly became one with the loss of the whole experience, which, as I now stated, round that dusty schoolroom, like the man recovering from unconsciousness, had already vanished, had eluded me at the very moment when I could first say, it is. And I knew at once, with fatal knowledge, that to have it again was the supreme and only important object of desire. Elusive, but tantalizing. Like a dream that you have had that was very vivid, and then you woke up and you couldn't get back into the dream again, but oh, how you wish you could. I said, after I found out about the glories of the chocolate malts in the snack shop, that sometime, just once before I died, I wanted to have again the experience back when malts cost 20 cents. And they mixed them up in that nice tall metal thing, and they poured it out in a nice tall glass, and then they gave you the glass and probably a spoon to scoop it up because it was so thick, and they gave you the metal too. We did it. But Lewis couldn't do that. You know, he'd still say, I can remember it. Something like that. It was wonderful. I'd like to get back into it. And yet, you can't. And then it comes, and it's like some teasing fairy or something, and reminds you, and you chase after it, and again, you don't find it, you don't feel it, you have a sense of loss, and it's all the worse because it is loss. And it should be attainable. Now, I'll be trying to talk some more tomorrow about how this ties in with the God is God. That seems to be that far away from the religious. But you see, in the matter of belief in God also, it is not easily stated and not always uniformly experienced. But we do at times have a sense of a belonging to God, an ideal relationship to Him, which we certainly do not realize now. I don't mean that we're all a bunch of miserable stumblebums or anything like that. It's stated in the words of a classic theologian who also did a very great autobiography, St. Augustine. He's everybody's saint. And he put it this way, Thou hast made us for Thyself, O God, and our hearts are ill at ease until they find their rest in Thee. And that, I think, is something that we may have experienced, not put quite those words to it. We have known that there is a depth relationship to God that we have missed, that we have neglected, and then we find and we say, this is it again. And I'm reminded of an athlete type. He was almost too much of the stereotype at college. Because he was an athlete, he didn't have to go to chapel. The rest of us were checked out. And he certainly didn't have to take part in religious activities. And he went out from college and had a professional career playing and coaching, and he came back. And then he found a pastor that he had somehow apparently heard or heard about. And this was his story. I knew when I was here that God was after me, but I wasn't having any part of it. Now, I want want to be instructed. I want to come into the church. How do you explain that? And this, I think, correlates in some ways with what Susan was talking about in the gospel. It's not so much a matter of baptism, it's not a matter of whether you were baptized. It simply says there is a kind of a memory of a golden age when we were happy with God. Strange. Now, I like irony. I think when we were talking about Pilgrim, maybe it was last week, that Elmer Witt did something, I didn't hear it. When he raised the question, does God laugh? Remember that one of the early Psalms, is it Psalm 2? He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion, and so on. What's God laughing at? At the pretensions of the world. How does God work? God moves in a mysterious way. Who does God's work? We like to say God's people. But God has a way of working through the people who don't know they're working for him, and if they knew, wouldn't want to work for him. Some of these very popular forms of Eastern battle, hand comment, work on the, combat, work on the principle of using your opponent's strength. I always thought that'd be sort of nice. I haven't weighed too much. I haven't weighed too many pounds. I've weighed too much for my height sometimes, and haven't been very strong. But if I could learn that so that I could tackle that 280-pound fellow who tackles me, let him use his strength, and I flick him over my shoulder, that would be nice. It's a pretty good picture of the way God operates. What's the irony here? Let me find this quickly. We have Lewis, who is an atheist, and associates with atheists and is not very open to believers' testimonies. And then in conversation, hears this fellow say, and I must have put down my wrong notation here. I'm not going to be able to find it at the proper place. So, I'll quote it. This man says, and he's been declaiming in the Commons room among other faculty people about his atheism. Then he says, funny thing. This story about the God who dies and rises again. It's almost as though there's something to it. Now, he hadn't been hired by the local Salvation Army to get on to Lewis. It's just a plain statement. There's no record that he went on and said, there is something to it. But Lewis had been going on in sort of a protected cocoon with his own introspective views. Nobody had succeeded in shaking him there. He'd been in a lot of debates. But this jars him. Some of us have been talking about what's been going on outside, in the last 2 weeks, and we don't even betake ourselves to the library and see what the paper has to report, because we're pretty sure what it will say about Reagan and Mondale. But can you imagine Mondale saying sometime, I think there's sense in what Reagan says.
That'll be the day.
But here is Lewis hearing the atheist say, there could be something to this business that really undergirds the Christian statement, God dies and is born again. There's another statement about another figure, and he's a notable figure in Lewis' experience. He calls him the Great Knock. That isn't his name, but he was a tutor who was preparing Lewis to go up to university. Sort of a neat way, and the kind of thing that Lewis liked. He was the only student. He lived at the home of his tutor. He didn't have to play games. He didn't have to stand athletic competition of his friends, and he could, he was committed to reading and studying, translating as much Greek as he could. He came to love it. The Great Knock was an atheist. And maybe I can find that at least. If not, Murphy has really triumphed today, 139. Now this seems, this sort of left-handed compliment, but it shows something also that indicates Lewis was not one of your common garden variety atheists. One who took it as a stance. We encounter those every so often in school. The rebel child who can't shock parents harshly enough, but comes home and says, I've been studying religion and doing such and such, and I've been talking a lot with my friends and not going to church on Sunday. I am now an atheist. And it doesn't carry much weight. You better listen. Understand the complex of answers. But here are some remarkable statements about the Great Knock. Having said that he was an atheist, I hasten to add that he was a rationalist of the old, high and dry 19th century type. For atheism has come down in the world since those days and mixed itself with politics and learned to dabble in dirt. The anonymous donor who now sends me anti-God magazines hopes, no doubt, to hurt the Christian in me. He really hurts the ex-atheist. You'll find, if you have ever encountered one of the little gems of Lewis's writing, the Screwtape letters, that when one demon is teaching another demon how to tempt effectively, he is not using the frontal attack of saying, well, you've just got to make him an atheist. Lewis has the wit to see that that's usually not much of a threat. Some people are genuinely that, but to be a confirmed atheist takes work, and most people don't bother about that. They'd rather just make some snap judgment and not consider any of the issues. For Lewis, then, we see that while he is threatened by some of these things and pulled this way and that, he moves on, and although I expect that many of you will be around tomorrow, and a couple of you might be back to hear some more, you like the end of the book, and so do I when I read a whodunit. I don't care to have to wait until next week when the new installment comes out. Lewis comes to faith, and how? And it seems to come very abruptly, and without any causation. That's one of the mysterious things. He has come to the point, tomorrow's lesson, where he says, God is God. But that doesn't make him a Christian. He says it makes him a theist. Well, now here, he tells how he became a believer in Jesus as the Christ. And you might not like it very well, might think it's very complete. I know very well when, but hardly how, the final step was taken. I was driven to Whipsnade one sunny morning. Whipsnade was a zoo, and that doesn't have any bearing. Neither does the fact that he was riding in the sidecar of his brother Walter's motorcycle, unless bouncing along would make some spiritual experience happen. All right. When we set out, I did not believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and when we reached the zoo, I did. After reading this book through pretty honestly, my students say it falls flat. Doesn't say why. Doesn't say what was the final push over the brink. And I think Lewis meant it to be that way. And that's why I say God works in a mysterious way. You can't say, this did it. Not everybody can say what Lewis says, it happened then. What happened? I came to faith. I came to 5 o'clock. Thank you.